there looks like a man who can foreclose on a home. Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Narrative First Podcast, the weekly podcast where story is always king. I'm your host, Jim Hull, the voice of Narrative First, and this is episode number 16, Predicting Who Will Listen to Your Story. Welcome back. Hope everybody had a great weekend. I had a chance to go out and see Hell or High Water, the second in the trilogy of the End of the West stories written by Taylor Sheridan. I guess Sicario was his first one. And then this was his second one, which I believe was originally called Comancheria, and was the winner of the 2012 Blacklist. I was really excited, really pumped up to see the movie. My analysis will tell you my eventual feelings at the end of it. And then after that, we will get into this week's topic of predicting who will actually listen to your story. Last week, since the last podcast, I wrote up an analysis of Florence Foster Jenkins, which you can see in the show notes, link to it. And then also I did a Throughline Thursdays for the film. And if you're not aware of, every Thursday I do a Throughline analysis of a film. Usually it's one that I had just seen that just came out either in theaters or streaming. And I put together a little graphic that shows you where the main character, influence character, relationship story and overall story through lines, where they line up in the usual Dramatica chart, where situation is in the upper left, fixed attitude is in the lower right, activities is in the upper right, and manner of thinking is in the lower left. And here's a little challenge for everybody who loves Dramatica. See how far down into the model you can get. I used to have it sitting on the seat next to me when I would commute to Disney every day when I was an animator, and I would sit and memorize past, progress, future, present. I'm a little addicted. That's why the site used to be called Story Fanatic. Understanding, doing, obtaining, learning, and I can actually go pretty much all the way down to the elements by now, which is scary, but that's my autistic brain for you. So yes, you can see the Florence Foster Jenkins analysis, the Throughlines Thursday for that same film. Also, if you are a monthly member, you will be getting your double issue, summer issue of the newsletter this week. John Gentry helped me put together the War Gist, and he's also going to help me do the teen sex comedy. That's the other one we're going to do, which will be really fun to put together. What you should do is mix the teen sex comedy with the fantasy gists from January and see what you come up with. See what Gandalf and teenagers can do together. And then also, I'm promising I will finish up the story forming series for the Dark Horse. Because it's been a month, I got kind of caught up in the real-world analysis and putting all that stuff up about ESPN last week, which has gotten great response, so I'm happy I did it, but the fun stuff I'm going to get back to. And eventually that story-forming series will just be a perk or a feature of people who are Narrative First members. So these first two are just going to be freebies so you can see what it's like, but then everyone after that will be only for those people that are members. And also, I just found out that The Get Down on Netflix is supposed to be good. Summer was watching it, and she says it's really good. It's got a complete story in the first episode, but she was afraid of me saying that and telling everybody that in case it doesn't have a complete story. But I'm saying it anyways, because it's fun. And so I guess I got to watch that. So now on to the analysis of Hell or High Water. As I mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, I was really looking forward to this film. I love westerns. I love success bad stories, which I was pretty sure that this was going to end up being, which it was. But I also love films that have complete stories, and unfortunately this one doesn't have complete stories. It's got a great trailer. It's got great stuff where you see tracking shots as they go past, you know, debt relief signs or reverse mortgage signs, and you know that they're robbing the banks, but they're the good guys because the banks have been robbing us, man. And this is our turn to put it to them. And then, of course, Jeff Bridges as the Texas Ranger. There looks like a man who can foreclose on a home. That's my Jeff Bridges. He does it much better than I do. So I was really looking forward to it. But unfortunately, all those moments that you see in the trailer don't really add up to a convincing argument. I mean, it's there and it's interesting, but it doesn't really tie into the overall story, which is the first downfall of it. I kept waiting for it to kind of add up to something more than what was being presented, but it really was just, well, this is the sad state of things. I mean, it was interesting where there was a fire going through a ranch and they couldn't do anything about it. And, you know, my kids aren't going to be able to do this anymore. That kind of stuff is interesting, but it doesn't really lead to anything. It doesn't tie into the approaches that Bridges or Chris Pine or Ben Foster like actually employ in the narrative. And the big unfortunate thing is there was no changed paradigm in the entire narrative. You know, for a story to actually mean something, for it to be a complete story, there has to be some perspective change so that you understand, well, the reason why it was success bad is because they changed to this paradigm. And that's what we're arguing, that going by this approach, you know, it'll get you success, it'll set your family up, but you'll be in a miserable spot. But unfortunately, nobody actually changed. Like, nobody changed their perspective, their paradigm, the way that they see the world. Obviously, Chris Pine's supposed to be the main character because he's the only one that we have any kind of real connection with. You know, we get to know that he has a history where, you know, he hasn't been able to pay his ex-wife support for over a year. So, you know, out of shame, he's not going to see his kids, doesn't want to, you know, be there, doesn't feel right about it. So, you know, the bank robberies are an effort to kind of pay her back so that he can get in good graces with her, you know, pay off his mom's mortgage and then give that ranch to his kids. So we've got a great reason for his motivation for what he does. And we have, you know, an intimate look into that, especially when he goes to visit his son and they have a beer there in the back porch, which looks extremely depressing. I don't think I ever want to go to Texas. It's so sad. And then, you know, so at first it seems like maybe his brother, Ben Foster, who's always amazing to watch, you know, that he'll be the influence character because he's the wild and crazy one. But if you think about it, they actually have the same perspective when it comes to Texas and what it is they're doing. You know, the subjective argument about, you know, Old West versus New West, that kind of thing, they both are on the same page. So while they are, you know, at odds in the overall story, you know, when they're actually robbing the banks and Foster gets out of control and he goes a little too far and does what he does, you know, that's protagonist and contagonist going at it with each other, but there's no real subjective argument going in between the two. So their relationship, it's not really at odds. You don't really feel that heart that you would want to feel in a story like this. So Foster doesn't really act, you know, his character Tanner doesn't really act as the influence character to Toby. So the only other potential candidate would be Bridges. And, I mean, he definitely has a different view of things, right? Everybody wants him to move on, to give up, and to go sit on his porch and, you know, drink his beer and die. But he's still clinging on to the Old West, the way things used to be, right? He looks to his partner. It's kind of like that's his Tonto. And he's going to make racist remarks and, you know, do all kinds of things to put him in his place, you know, as the white man gets won over on the Indians, which is great. It's a great character that, like, he can't let that go. But, unfortunately, those two perspectives don't really come into conflict. So there's no real, like, relationship story throughout the whole thing. So it feels very guy film-ish because, you know, a lot of guy films don't feature that relationship because guys are uncomfortable with relationships for the most part. So they don't like to write about them. And so you kind of miss out that feeling of heart in it that you really want and that you want to explore through the narrative. So what happens is they're at odds with each other, but they don't ever actually come into conflict. You know, they don't meet until the very end. And then you get to that end and it's great on the porch, right? I mean, this is Bridges. He's finally sitting on the porch and this is his chance to, you know, get taken out before he has to grow old and see everything die. And so, you know, if he pulls his gun, that's steadfast, you know, because that's what he's always wanted to do. And Chris Pine can be there and decide, you know, okay, well, am I going to pull a gun on him or am I going to just sit there and be as cool and calm as I've always been? So there we have the real conflict between the two of them. Which one's going to change? Which one's going to change? And then Mom pulls up in her SUV. And it's like, what? And totally kills the tension out of everything. I don't know if this was the original script or what, but it kills the whole moment. It's a complete deus ex machina where now, you know, Bridges, clearly Pine isn't going to change. He's steadfast throughout the entire thing. I mean, there's no way he's going to change to his brother and just blow away Jeff Bridges right there on the porch. That was never going to happen. So obviously it was going to be Bridges that's going to have to change and accept that, you know, the West is over. That's it. But because Mom shows up, it's not like he's going to pull the gun on Chris Pine right there and blow him away in front of his kids and his ex-wife. I mean, there's no way, his character isn't that kind of character, so he's not going to do that anyways. So when he gets up and leaves, the question is like, okay, is he doing that because he's accepting the way things are, or is he like just doing it because, you know, mom showed up? And then so there's no meaning to everything that happened, and it's really disappointing because then they do the, you know, I'll see you around, not unless I see you first, you know, which is like, oh, all right, I'll come after you later. And so I guess Bridges is still steadfast because he hasn't meaningfully changed, and Chris Pine's character hasn't meaningfully changed. I mean, he's in a worse place, feels bad about everything, but he's still steadfast. And so you don't have that changed paradigm. And so when you look at the entire narrative, it really doesn't add up to anything. And it's really frustrating. You know, it's like when Jenny told Forrest, you know, hey, I'm sorry, can you take care of my kid? But after she finds out she has AIDS from after all the fun she had. So that doesn't even make sense. It's like, well, you're just doing that because somebody's got to look after your kid. It's not like you had this change of heart before. And so the same thing with Bridges, like, he may have a change of heart, but because it happens after mom shows up, it kind of kills any meaningful switch there. You know, like, if he had gotten up and said, all right, well, I'll see you later, or there would have been better dialogue than that before mom showed up, then I could see it, you know, maybe actually meaning something, or, I don't know, some ending with him where we get to see that change, then I could see that the film would be worth the 99%. Okay, so it's still an amazing, I mean, not amazing, it's a really fun film to watch, because the bank robber scenes are great, and it is interesting to see, you know, what it's like to live in West Texas currently, which doesn't seem like that much fun. And of course, watching Jeff Bridges is amazing. Any chance you get that, that's a great thing to do. So it's worth checking out, but just know that in the end, the narrative really doesn't add up to much of anything, and unfortunately isn't one of the, you know, really great stories of the year, but I would still check it out just to be able to see what happens when you interrupt a narrative, you know, with the hand of God coming in and saving everybody from, you know, an actual emotional paradigm shift. On to this week's topic, which is not about real world, but is actually about your audience. So most of dramatic, all the different story points that you get, it's all about the actual story itself. And there are just objective elements, objective appreciations of your story that, you know, you can stand back and look at your narrative and go, okay, I'm missing this part, I'm missing this part, how can I fill in the holes and create a balanced narrative? But there are some audience appreciations that Chris and Melanie identified that can help you understand how your audience will react. Like, you can actually predict, in the same way that last week I showed how Chris and Melanie were able to predict, you know, where ESPN would end up this year, you can also predict what kind of an audience will show up and watch your film based on the story points you choose. So, you know, just to start off, out of the 32,767 different story forms that Dramatica can predict, there are a couple that are duplicates, so that you'll get down to the very end, and every single story point will be selected, even all the signposts, all the additional story points, everything, all the way down, except for one, which will be the story limit. And you'll switch between option lock or time lock, and you'll notice that nothing changes. It's like, it's almost as if, like, the story limit isn't really connected to anything. You know, it just seems like it's a dummy switch, because it doesn't actually change anything. And this is only in some of the story forms. In fact, if you played through most of it, you would see that all the story forms, the story limit really doesn't seem to do anything. You know, the question comes up, like, well, why is that? You know, when you play around with other story points in Dramatica, it always seems to affect something else. And that's when people get frustrated, because they want a B or main character, but then they want them to also be in a situation. And they don't understand why Dramatica forces, well, I hate Dramatica because it wouldn't let me do a B or in a situation through line. And then they get really mad because, well, I can't do that. Well, Dramatica can't tell me what to do. And then they give up. And of course, then their stories will never be sound, because you don't have a beer in a situation because they're actually a doer. And I'll explain why that is. The point is, like, most of these story points, they're all interconnected. All the story points are connected. And actually, the story limit is connected. It's just not actually revealed in the current version of the software. And I'll get to that in a second. So, for instance, like, getting back to the main character approach. So if you choose beer, you'll notice that in the main character through line, it's going to force his through line to either be in a fixed attitude or a manner of thinking. And the reason for that is once you know you have a problem, you know, it automatically creates a solution, and the main character thinks that's where the solution is, right? Like, so, you know, if I need to lose weight, I guess I gotta stop eating, or I need to start working out, right? So they're trying to work on their external thing. Or if the main character has an issue with depression, and they their first thing isn't going to be working out and eating right, their first thing is going to be trying to, like, will themselves out of that depression. Like, well, I'll just be happier. Okay, so that is a beer in a fixed attitude, depression, trying to be or will their way out of their depression. Usually both solutions don't work either way, doer or beer, but that's where the main character actually starts, and that's why when you pick main character approach of doer or beer, it sets the actual domain of where that problem will be. And then there are other similar story points, like if you choose a main character resolve of steadfast, then the symptom and response have to be the same in the main character and the overall story through line. And if you pick change, then the problem and solution are forced to be the same in the overall story and the main character through line. And why that is, you know, there's a huge theoretical explanation for it, and I'll give a link to in the show notes to a past article I wrote about it. But essentially, a steadfast character, the story is all about the work that needs to be done. And in a work story, it's not so much the problem and solution that is as important as the symptom and response. And likewise, in a changed story, it's all about the dilemma, right? In Star Wars or The Matrix, it's all about that final choice. What am I going to do? And then so then you want to focus on the problem and solution. It's not like Braveheart or something like Memento, where it's all about the work, all about what I think the problem is and what I think I need to do to solve it. That features at the center of the story. So at first they seem arbitrary until you understand, you know, until you start to understand why Dramatic is making all these selections. But that still doesn't explain the story limit. Like, why is that still not connected? Well, what you have to understand is that model of Dramatica that you see, all those boxes and squares with all the crazy words in them, that, again, I will link to in the show notes at the end here. When you look at that, you're actually looking at the story mind. The model of the mind, that's at rest. Like, there's no tension in there. Everything's perfectly balanced, right? Past is directly across from the present. Past is in the same location as memory when you compare situation and a fixed attitude. Obtaining is in the same location as changing one's nature, you know, because obtaining is the same thing in an activity as it is changing one's nature in a psychology point of view. So all those are perfectly balanced. Everything's, like, completely balanced. Nothing's at odds. And when you go to make all those changes, when you set the main character resolve and the approach, the story outcome, story drivers, what happens is the engine inside begins to wind up the model. Like Melanie's example is always of a Rubik's Cube tied with rubber bands. And you start turning and flipping and rotating the cube, and it gets tighter and tighter and tighter until you get as tight as you possibly can get, and then it's time to start the story, right? And then that first story driver comes along, that inciting incident, and kind of, like, flips a little switch. And then it twists a little bit, and it starts to unravel, and all that tension begins to play out until it goes back to rest at the end of the story. And that's actually how a narrative functions. That's how it actually works. So setting those story points isn't some arbitrary thing that's just for fun and, oh, let's look at all the past stories that we've ever seen and then we'll tell you exactly what order things should be in based on stories that have worked in the past. It's actually based on a psychological model of the mind. And when you set those different things, it determines, you know, which through lines get wound up first. If you choose approach, it'll tell whether the, you know, the main character through line is in a positive or a negative position in the chart. If you choose the growth of stop or start, that'll determine whether it's in a companion relationship with the overall story or a dependent relationship. Like, it sets all these different things and sets how things are flipped and rotated and wound up. Like, that's what makes a story different, is the way that it's all wound up. You know, every model at rest is the same, but every story, those 32,000 different permutations of the model, they're different because of how it's all wound up. And so the story limit, it turns out, determines, you know, when you go to flip things around, rotate things around, it determines whether the children underneath are brought along with it, or are they left behind? Like, do things change so fast that it leaves the children behind, or does it bring it along with them? And then that's how you start to begin to see what actually happens in every scene. So right now, the model that you see right now, it'll tell you what'll happen in each act, which is great, and usually that's too much for people to deal with altogether. But it'll tell you what is supposed to happen in each act for each through line. So you have, you know, 16 different beats for the entire story. If you're actually able to see what elements were carried over when things were flipped and rotated, you could actually sit there and you could tell what is supposed to be played out in each and every scene, almost like, oh, this is what this character should say at this moment, this is what this character should say. And I think, you know, in the original, there's like a 100-page report, 200-page report for just one narrative, which is crazy. That would have totally killed all creativity. And what they decided to do was to keep the balance right now. Like, you can be able to predict things and be able to see, you know, where the narrative is headed, but it's not so prescriptive that you are, like, locked into doing it a certain way. There is one area, the plot sequence report, which usually gives people tons of confusion and messes them up, because it shows a little bit of what's carried over with this story limit. It shows you, you know, what children are carried over into different quads and which ones are left behind, and you can begin to see what the justified look of the story looks like. You know, when it's all wound up, that's a justified view of the story, because it's all the justifications are in place, and then you have to unravel them. So the plot sequence is kind of like a gap in between this overly done version of it, you know, if we were able to see what the story limit did, and the current version, what we have now. And it's a good way to, like, test the waters if you wanted to see if that could help you out. Typically, I don't use it except in the roadmap that I do. I choose one through line, you know, whichever one the writer is most interested in, and I use that plot sequence to kind of help develop it out. But to me, it's overkill, particularly in a screenplay. There's, like, barely enough time, because, you know, it's only supposed to be 100 pages now or something, 105. Nobody has time to read anything, and nobody has the patience, so I think it's overkill. And especially knowing the story limit, what would come over is complete overkill. But there is one thing about the story limit which is really cool that has nothing to do with the actual structure, and it has to do with these audience appreciations that I was talking about. If you combine the story limit with the main character's problem-solving style, you can actually predict who will show up to see your film, or who will purchase your novel, or who will show up to your play. And the way it works is, if you have a linear problem solver in an option lock story, that will attract the biggest audience, right? If you have a linear character in a time lock story, that will only attract male audience members. If you have a holistic main character in an option lock story, that will just bring in female audience members. And it turns out if you have a holistic character in a time lock story, no one's going to actually show up to see it. And I'll get into that. And of course, I'll leave a link to it. This week's article will have this all explained out with a really nice graphic. So if you're not listening to this until Thursday or Friday, you should be able to just click and be able to read it. So why is that? Okay, so linear and holistic, typically those fall along gender lines. Originally, the story point was known as the mental sex and male or female. And that's because they were trying to be controversial. This was like 1993, 1994, and I was like, what? Men and women think differently? No, that can't be. Now, most people are kind of comfortable with it, and it's okay, and it doesn't mean one's lesser than the other. It just says, hey, one's different. And it's generally speaking. It's not the end of the world. So typically, male audience members think linearly, and female audience members think holistically. So the message of that is clear. If you want the largest audience, you make your main character solve problems linearly and put them in a story that has a dwindling set of options. If you want the smallest audience, you put a holistic thinker in a story limited by time. And that feels weird to even say, right? Like, somebody who thinks holistically is going to be worried about time? That doesn't even make sense, because it shouldn't, because a holistic thinker has no concept of time, because they sit on time in order to look at everything. They're looking at the changes in everything and the acceleration and deceleration of forces all the time. So time to them is something that you can just easily adjust in your head. Like, a minute seems like a year, seems like a minute, right? You will create a character that's completely disaffected and disinterested in the story. It's like putting a main character in a story who could care less about the story. So if you want to do that, that's great, but you're not going to get a huge audience. And the two middle ones, you know, the linear time lock or the holistic option lock, which are either, you know, male-oriented or female-oriented respectively, those are all based just on the blind spots in male and female audience members. So when it comes to male audience members, they can't stand people who don't think the way they do. They just can't stand it. They don't get it. They think it's completely nuts to try and balance out the environment as a way of solving problems. Because the way you solve problems is you attack problems. You don't balance out things. It doesn't even make sense. And that's why your guy's guy friends, you know, your macho jocks who laugh at you when you say you like Moulin Rouge, the reason why they say that is because they're uncomfortable because, you know, Christian's about to be caught by the Duke, you know, for trying to hook up with Satine. And so instead of punching or kicking his way out of there, he starts singing a song, which seems completely just out of nowhere. And they'll feel very uncomfortable with that. They might even say, well, this is so gay. And the reason why they say that is because they have no words to describe people that think holistically. So they just put it in the category of, well, that's gay and stupid. And so, you know, hey, if you want a trick to be able to find out if the person you're dealing with is a linear or holistic thinker, that would be one way, is to ask if they liked Moulin Rouge. So, yeah, that's a response from a linear thinker, that completely ignorant response, because they don't understand that that's a perfectly acceptable way to solve problems, and it actually gets them out of the jam that they're in at that time. The point is that, you know, holistic thinking works 50% of the time, and linear thinking works 50% of the time, but you can't tell a linear thinker that, or they'll probably punch you in the face. So then go to the female audience member's blind spot, and for them, the story limit is the curse. Like, they totally get options because, you know, they're used to juggling 5 million things at once as they holistically go through the world. So, well, of course, options. I totally get that. Yeah, I can see how my options are dwindling. But you get to time, and they're like, what are you talking about? There's no such thing as a deadline. What are you freaking out for? There's tons of time. And that's because, you know, when it came to having to sit in a cave for 9 months, and, you know, you weren't allowed to do anything, you just had to sit there and wait for this alien creature to come out of your body, then, of course, you know, you would want 9 months to feel like 9 seconds, too. So you developed this way of dealing with things, which created a holistic method of problem solving. You know, and over time, you know, this was... was deemed an unimportant or overlooked way of approaching things. But as we get into this 21st century now, and there's like a return to the feminine, and everybody understands holistic problem solving, particularly, you know, when you think of the internet and technology and how everybody's connected and we're all one people, it's like, oh, okay, well, this is the way things are going. Just don't take a holistic thinker to see High Noon or 310 to Yuma or Armageddon, because they will likely despise you until you find a way to balance out their annoyance with you. So if you think about it, just like the Dramatica's ability to predict ESPN's future, if you think back to 93 or 94 when Chris and Melanie first came out with this, they had no history, no backlog of analysis to determine whether or not this theory was right. It's like, well, how do you know linear option lock stories are going to be more popular than, or more prevalent than holistic time lock stories? And they didn't. But once again, they predicted it, and it's so crazy that more people don't know about this. But after 22 years of analysis, we have over 310 different films, plays, and novels that you can go through on Dramatica.com. And if you look, the results pretty much prove them correct. If you're at your computer or you're online, what you can do is you can go to dramatica.com/analysis/filter, and you'll see a collection of tools, drop-down menus, where you can actually go through and select different story points and see what stories over the last 22 years have those story points in them. So what we're going to do is look at the audience reach. We're going to look at this combination of the main character problem-solving style with the story limit and see if Chris and Melanie were right with their predictions of where narratives would fall. So go ahead and under main character problem solving style, put linear, and for the story limit, choose option lock. And if Chris and Melanie were right with their predictions, that should be the largest amount of stories over the last 22 years. And if you look, out of 320 different films, plays, and novels, 210 of them feature linear main characters within an option lock story limit. That's crazy. That's over two-thirds of all stories that were analyzed. And these are films and novels and plays. You know, obviously the Shakespeare stuff was written a long time ago before Dramatica. Several of the films are in the early 20th century, or mid-20th century, actually. And, you know, it's from before and after 93 and 94. And you'll see over two-thirds of them are linear option lock stories, which is incredible. Their predictions were right, and most people write linear main characters within option lock stories. That's why whenever I work with clients, I always tell them, a lot of them want to do holistic because they want to try something different, and I always tell them, well, do you want people to actually read this story, or do you want to do something cool? And both purposes are okay, but for the most part, people want to get the largest audience. So if you want the largest audience, you want to hardwire in that linear main character with an option lock story. And then we can try out the other permutation. So let's try a linear main character in a time lock story. Okay, so these would be what would be considered like guys guy films. And you'll see there's only 12 out of 320. There's only 12 linear time lock stories, which is hilarious because that means not too many people are interested in seeing a linear main character work against time, right? Oh, I've only got 48 hours to save the Earth. It's okay, but it just seems really like obvious and apparent and not too exciting. And then if we switch it and we do the holistic main character problem solving style with an option lock story, these are the quote unquote chick flicks, right? These are the Moulin Rouges of the bunch. And you'll see there's a significant amount more. There's 84. So, you know, 210 are linear option lock. That's the first two thirds over the last 22 years. And the next third is taken up by either the guy's guy film or the chick flick, you know, the linear time lock or the holistic option lock, which now leaves the holistic time lock stories, which is hilarious because that's the first thing I wanted to try, of course, when I learned about Dramatica. I'm going to write the first great holistic time lock story. And I wrote the story about this little kid that couldn't relate to anyone and could care less what was really going on. It was a really great story. And obviously, you haven't heard of it. Nobody will. So if you select holistic time lock, out of 320 different stories, there are only four that fall into place. Only four, which is insane. And I just added, the reason that this came up is because this week I'm going to add in Sideways finally, which was a recent analysis, as a holistic time lock, right? Giamatti is a holistic main character, and it's a week until the wedding, so obviously that's a holistic time lock story. But you look at the other ones, My Fair Lady, you know, she's not really interested in what's going on in the overall story, and besides it ends halfway through. That's great. The American President is hilarious because they actually went and put in both option lock and time lock. You know, there's so many days until the election, which is the time lock, and then they have to get a certain amount of votes, which is the option lock. So they did both in there, which is kind of a cheat, so they could get both audiences. So that's why that film wasn't as unpopular as it probably could have been. And then, of course, there's Donnie Darko, which no one gets or wants to see anyways. That's your collection of holistic time lock stories. So if you want to write a story that nobody's interested in and no one will go to, you know, make sure you give them a main character who could care less about what's happening in the story and the pressures that come down upon them. So there you have it. Like back in 1993, Chris and Melanie, they came up with this wackadoodle theory and, you know, predicted, well, this is where, you know, if you go and look through all these films, this is what you're going to find. You know, they didn't go through and say, you know, in all these great films, this is when the main character crosses the threshold, and this is when he goes into the cave, and then he comes around back into the new world. It's like, no. These are story points, and based on human psychology, stuff that we've observed in human behavior, you're going to find that most narratives fall into this category, and fewer narratives fall into this category, which to me, it's fantastic. It's 22 years of proof that this thing actually works. And you know, the proof is in looking at all these films after the fact. You know, countless hours of sweat and turmoil go into the creation of a story, and that's the mission of Narrative First, is to help people get the story right from the beginning, to actually think of the narrative first instead of kind of futz around with it and think about what audiences will like and what's popular and trending and all this stuff. It's like, no, let's just actually work on a great narrative and make that work functionally, and then you can decide how much icing you want to put on it and what flavors you want to add here and there to make it more popular. But when it comes down to actually predicting the audience that will show up, you can actually do that with just structure. You can do it with setting linear option lock. You're going to get the most people. Or if you want to turn off guys, you do holistic option lock. You know, you just do Moulin Rouge or Social Network, and that's it. You know, you get what you get. If you want to just attract sports fans, you do linear time lock stories. Or if you want nobody to show up, you do the holistic time lock stories. So yes, great narrative can be predicted. You can actually predict how things are going to turn out. It's not this like magical, ooh, you know, the muse came down and gifted me with this idea and I wrote it, and because of my sheer natural talent, I was able to acquire a massive audience. No, you can actually write a story that will attract the largest audience just based on structure, based on how the main character goes about solving their problems and the actual limit put into place that brings a story to a close. Hope you enjoyed the episode this week. Next week, we'll get into even more story structure and story analysis. Be sure to look out for that story forming series on The Dark Horse, and of course, the full analysis of Sideways, which will be up on Dramatica.com. Hope you have a great week. Have fun writing, and we'll see you next time.